Case number 21-3798, Blue Water Importers, Inc. versus Thomas Strickrath, et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Vasvari, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I believe I did it on a form, but I would also like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if I need to do it now. Thank you. This is a case with a very long and convoluted procedural history, and it turns on the interpretation of a Byzantine set of federal regulations that govern the import of used motor vehicles into the United States generally and used Canadian motor vehicles into Ohio specifically. The federal regulations don't just cover Ohio, of course, they cover national import. And it's a very substantial market. Many tens of millions of dollars, many thousands of vehicles are imported from Canada every year, largely because the United States and Canada have very similar.
Yeah, but counsel, right now, are your clients not getting anything that they want? I mean, the issue before us, at least potentially, is mootness. So as I read the briefs and all, right now, your folks are being treated exactly the way they want to be treated. Am I wrong?
You are not wrong. You're correct. The policy itself was enacted in October of 2016, and it was on the books for 14 months until December of, 2015.
15,
right. And it was on the books for 14 months until December 2016. In the interim, and this is probably one of the most significant facts, two things happened in those 14 months. In March of 2016, the state defendants, who are the, well, you know who they are at this point, I'm sure. I'm not gonna belabor the details because there's so many. The state defendants consulted with a man named Coleman Sachs, who works for NHTSA, the National Highway Transport and Safety Administration, and they're the ones who administer, have been delegated the authority by the Secretary of Transportation to administer the entire import scheme, which we've detailed at excruciating length in our briefs. And they learned that the bond release letter, which NHTSA is ordinarily required to issue within 30 days of the completion by a registered importer of what's called the compliance package, wasn't being issued, as a matter of fact, in 30 days. It was being issued as often as, 8 months after the submission and completion of that package. Now, as we've noted, the CFR, I think it's 48 CFR 592.8E, vouches safe to the holder or the owner of a vehicle imported from Canada, whose registered importer has duly performed all of the conversions necessary to bring it into compliance with American standards and has certified that in an extremely detailed process to NHTSA, and must submit a bond with respect to those conversions equal to 150% the value of the vehicle, and becomes the manufacturer, the de jure manufacturer of that vehicle for life, responsible for maintenance, recalls, anything. 30 days after the submission of that package, if NHTSA has not said, hold the vehicle for further inspection, we are not convinced, then NHTSA must issue a bond release letter. But failing that, twice in the Federal Code of Regulations, it's provided that the owner of that vehicle may effectively release it into stream of commerce for sale, use on the public roads, or for titling. Now, Ohio has a very large volume of these vehicles. In some years, as many as 45,000-50,000 come in. And there were concerns upon the clerks of court about the documentation that's necessary to secure an Ohio title, without which one can't sell or transfer the car. Bring it into Ohio, it sits there, it can't be transferred. So Ohio's bond release requirement that's at issue in this case was adopted in October 2000.
Counsel, again, I understand.
I'm sorry.
I understand that they did you wrong in a sense.
I know.
In the past, or at least for these purposes, but now they that's, I'm going back to my original question, what is your current gripe with Ohio? I mean, I understand, I don't know whether the U.S. is releasing these, in fact, bonds, but that's the U.S.'s problem. What's Ohio doing to you now that you're complaining about?
Well, Ohio rescinded the policy.
Okay.
And they went forward to claim that it was moot. But I think that they failed manifestly to carry the burden that this court has set out for demonstrating mootness on the basis of the voluntary cessation of an unconstitutional or at least a contested practice. Now, the court has consistently, this court and the Supreme Court, has used words like a very heavy burden. This court has described it as a burden which is rarely met and has to be carried by the defendants in various ways. And yet, if you look at this record, the district court was, for lack of a better word and with no criticism, indulgent. It indulged the presumption, and I think it indulged the bare representation on the part of the state that this policy was gone and it would not be renewed.
And they have, I mean, it's now been, what, 4 years, 5 years since it was rescinded. So, I mean, I've sometimes been in cases, you know, we've had all these cases on vaccines and so on where they say, well, you know, we changed it 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, but they changed it, what is it now, 5+ years ago.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
Let me say three things in that regard. And the first is the district court reasoned that way as well. And I think that reasoning is incorrect. I don't think the state gets the benefit of having kept the policy on the books while it was in litigation and throughout that litigation defended its constitutionality.
So would that, you know, are they always on the hook to decide this if it was 10 years, 20 years?
Well, in this case, it was the duration of one federal lawsuit. And from the time that they rescinded it, and we cite this at four different places on the merits during the course of this, not counting this appeal, they have nonetheless maintained that the policy was constitutional.
Well, have they ever really claimed that federal law does require a bond release letter, or just that they have the ability to regulate generally in the area, even though there's federal regulation in the area?
Well, we asserted, you know, and I don't know that we ever used the magic words, but it was clear that our argument was this: this was both field preemption and conflict preemption.
Mm-hmm.
And they argued that there was no preemption in a motion to dismiss that was filed, I left my notes over there, 2017. And at
no field or no conflict? Or?
None. No preemption at all. Their contention was that, well, the regulation said that a vehicle may be released for titling. Nothing bound the states to title it. That motion to dismiss was denied, and it was denied on the merits by Judge Helmick when, you know, he was the middleman who had the case between its inception and Judge Sargas deciding it. And his contention and his argument, and you can read it, I think it's at pages 807 and 808, page IDs in the record, record number 54, is that there's an absolute conflict preemption because the regulations cannot, Ohio's, one could comply completely with the federal regulations and be entitled to or vouchsafe the right to transfer and title the car, but not with Ohio because Ohio required the bond release letter, notwithstanding the 30 days. And the provision that said after 30 days, bond release letter or no, as a matter of federal law, you can title it. So that, you know, that never, the merits issue was never joined except on their motion to dismiss at that point. And, you know.
So you're really saying that, correct me if this is wrong, that in your view, Ohio claims the right to not title regardless of the federal regulations, even though it's not doing so now.
I think that's correct. That is a concise statement of what our claim is. If they haven't expressly reserved the right to reinstate the contested regulation or something like it, they certainly have not walked away from it. It's like Galileo being shown the instruments of torture and then whispering, you know, it does move. You know, they've got the King's X behind their back on that. And the question then becomes, and we cite in our brief case law where this court and the Supreme Court has raised it, if an entity continues to defend the constitutional merits of something that it has rescinded after the initiation of litigation, where does that go in the question of, you know, the two-part question, the heavy burden of showing that it is, you know, beyond reasonable to believe that the policy is going to be reenacted? Now, they have the power to do it. And what's more, all of the indicia of a policy that, you know, really ought
to say they have the power. It's simply that as an agency, they can write something and promulgate a regulation.
Correct. And they can
any time you had an administrative agency, you could make the same argument.
They
have the literal power to do it. Whether they have the legal power is another matter.
Well, whether they have the legal power as determined by the federal courts, correct. But as a matter of the Ohio Revised Code, these two defendants, the director of the public safety as supervisor and the registrar of the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, together between them have plenary power. The registrar can issue something. He is subject only to the correction of the director. So they have plenary power.
The director is a gubernatorial appointee.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. So that would change. Policies can change, administrations change, and this court and others have consistently held that the unilateral ability within an agency to reinstate, discontinued policy is one of the indicators that says that mootness ought not to be found. There are others. Whether or not the policy was changed in the wake of or as a result of or in response to litigation. Now, the district court below looked at the 14-month history of this, and it said, it was only 2 months after our suit was filed that the policy was rescinded, which indicates some sort of a good faith. And yet, for the 8 months after it's being rescinded, it's been defended on the merits. And what the district court, which was bound to consider by the law all of the circumstances involving the adoption and the rescission of the policy, failed to note is that the state consistently said, we consulted with this fellow, Coleman Sachs at NHTSA, who told us about the bond release and the administration requirements that were tardy. And then we went away and changed the policy. Well, what they don't note is that the whole policy lasted for 14 months. 9 months passed, and a lawsuit was filed between the time they learned of those mistakes and the time they did something.
Counsel, there was some discussion in the depositions about some kind of document or document production. Is there any indication at this point of any document subsequent to the conversation with Coleman Sachs?
I have not seen such a document. There was a letter from Coleman Sachs to the Dealers Association's attorney that we put into evidence, but I haven't seen anything.
When was that letter sent?
That letter was sent actually the same month as they consulted, so I think it was March.
In March of 2016. Okay.
And the dealers had called it to their attention. The problem here is that 9 months counts for something. It shows them holding on to the policy for 7 months until the lawsuit is filed and two more. That's not, I think, an indicator of an agency in good faith trying to get it right. More than 40,000 cars, by average, were imported into Ohio during that period, and all of them suffered this bond release requirement. Time is up.
Any more questions?
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Brian Honan. I'm here on behalf of both the registrar and the director of the Department of Public Safety and the registrar of the Ohio Bureau of Motor Vehicles. As Judge Boggs, as you had alluded to earlier, this case really, there's one issue on this case. There's a very straightforward issue, and that is whether a state agency's voluntary secession of a policy done in consultation.
So you absolutely don't want us to rule for you on the merits?
I don't believe the merits are at issue in this case. They weren't ruled on by the lower court, and so I don't think they've ever been addressed. The lower court found that it didn't have jurisdiction to rule on the merits, so there was never any decision on the merits for you to rule upon, I would imagine.
But you do still say that you're right on the merits at some points, don't you?
Yeah, the BMV still argues that on the merits they were still correct. They were not in conflict with the federal regulations. The federal regulations allowed something to be released into commerce but it didn't necessarily direct that individual states have to title those beyond their rules. States obviously are in charge of titling their own vehicles, and states can limit or can enact their own rules and their own regulations and their own statutes regarding titling of motor vehicles, and that's what Ohio did. Regardless, whether it's deemed constitutional or not constitutional, the policy was rescinded, as counsel mentioned, 2 months after this litigation was filed. 7 months after the email from Coleman Sachs, just to clarify.
Now, because I asked him the question about this, to me, elusive email. Is there in the record or any indication that such a thing was ever sent or produced?
The email,
are you talking about the email to the dealers? Or the
So there was an email from, the email was between Coleman Sachs and members of the Department of Public Safety, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles.
Okay, where is that in the record?
That should be in the record. I can't, if I look it up, I can tell you exactly where in the record it is. It was May 2nd of 2016 was the email from Coleman Sachs. The March conversations were in emails between DPS individuals who actually...
Okay, no, I got that. So you say, and I'm only pressing you because I was not able to find it and my crack staff was not able to find it. You say there is an email from Coleman Sachs to the department as of May 2nd, is that correct?
Correct, it's either May 2nd or May 3rd, and I have a binder with them in there, I can flip through for a second if that's all right, I just don't want to.
Okay, no, I at least would like to see it because I was unable to find it, but obviously you know your case better than I.
So there's an email, it would be May 2nd, 2016, so it's in the document production, it's number 127, and it would have been attached to, I would imagine it was attached to appellant's brief, but it's in the document production.
Appellant's brief in?
In this case.
In this
yes.
record?
Correct.
Okay.
It was sent on May 6, 2016. It was provided through discovery.
Wait, on May 6th?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
2nd, May 3rd, and May 6th now.
May 2nd is the date the email was sent. It was a response. It was actually an email sent to Coleman Sachs with questions, and he responded to it. It was between, it was Nancy Blair, sent it to Coleman Sachs. And I'm sorry, the header to this email has May 6th because on May 6th, it was sent from Nancy Blair from the BMV to Sarah Stedfeld from the BMV. So there's two headers
okay,
in this email.
We'll try to find it then. Thank you.
But you don't have a docket site from the lower court.
I don't.
In front record of me. Site. Okay.
I don't. I apologize. It is in the record, and it was provided during discovery.
Okay.
It was May 2nd, and that is when the BMV learned about the difficulties that that NHTSA was having with the 30-day bond release letter requirement. Based on that. The BMV certainly, they began the process of changing their regulations and changing their guidance. I guess regulations.
When you say they began the process, then is there anything in the record that shows that?
So
again, there are depositions of at least Corrigan and Stedfeld, and again, I didn't see anything where they said, "Oh yeah, we read that and we realized it was an oopsie," and so then we. You know, had the lawyers start to draft and it took 5 months. I mean, that would be one explanation. I mean, the strongest point on his side to me is this considerable lapse of time, which then only culminates after they file suit. And so that's why I'm kind of pressing you on what happened after this May 2, or at least there's nothing in the record that I found about it. Can you help me?
Other than testimony from Sarah Stedfeld and from Kathleen Corrigan, there is no, there's nothing written after the
May. And that testimony doesn't really talk about a process of rescinding, does it?
No, it talks about a process in general of what steps it has to go through, who they went to when they were drafting the procedures, the policy, but it doesn't discuss
and when you
this
say
particular
the,
policy.
The policy, are you talking about the December rescission or the original policy?
Well, it would be both. It doesn't talk about either the policy that was followed or the steps that were followed in enacting the policy or in rescinding it in December of 2016. So there's nothing specifically that says that. There were general questions asked about steps that are taken in general and who these different types of policies would go through, what types of what are the levels of the BMV where these go through, and I think Sarah Stedfeld testified that it goes from her, and then Kathy Corrigan is her supervisor. Kathy Corrigan sends it to the deputy registrar. The deputy registrar sends it to the registrar, and of course it goes back and forth. There's also John Goulden, who was counsel at the time for the BMV, who was involved in writing it. So there were certainly meetings that were had, there were discussions had, but none of them are written in the record.
Well, counsel, let me ask you, what is there to prevent the BMV from reinstating this? Well, I'll let you answer that first, and then I'm going to have an immediate follow-up.
That's fine. First, there'd have to be a reason for them to reinstate it, and quite frankly, there isn't one. The reason that it was rescinded is because the federal government cannot always get a bond release letter out within 30 days.
So if NHTSA gave guidance to the BMV later on saying, you know what, we are now able to process these things really quickly. You know, the inflow of these vehicles from outside the country has substantially slowed, and we've got extra staff now, and so we're moving these things, and by and large, they're moving within 30 days. Would that be a change that might cause the BMV to say, you know what, we're going to reinstate this policy?
Well, so that issue hasn't come up to the BMV, so I can't speak for them, but there would be no reason to. There's two reasons for that. One, the current policy, as it is written, the rescinded policy regarding requiring the 30-day bond release letter, still allows for a bond release letter to be sent within 30 days. So the fact that the federal government would then be getting the bond release letters out within the 30 days would still be fine. They would be able to accept them. That would be, they wouldn't have to use the exception.
Just because they say that they can do it by and large, it would be the dealer who doesn't receive the release letter.
Correct. The first reason is you wouldn't need to change the policy. You can keep the policy the way it is and still accept bond release letters on time. In fact, I'm sure that happens more often than not accepting or not receiving the bond release letters on time. The second reason would be, this has happened before, it can happen again. Why would they reinstate a policy knowing that, sure, currently right now the federal government is able to, hypothetically, the federal government is able to release or send out bond release letters within the 30-day requirement. They've raised staffing, but that can change, and it can go back to the way it was. And if that happens, then they would have to institute yet another policy, reversing it yet again. There would be no reason to do it. It's not necessary. The policy in place now handles both situations. There's no reason for them to reinstate a strict bond release requirement. And because the federal regulations allow them to keep the bond release requirement and to keep the exception, the 30-day exception, they have no reason to. They're not required to implement a new regulation. And the BMV doesn't just implement regulations for the sake of implementing regulations. They do this. What is in the record are numerous communications, emails from stakeholders in this. There was an attorney, Erica Eversman, that represents the auto dealers associations or the independent auto dealers associations, multiple times emailing back and forth directly with the registrar about different issues. At the case below that are not at issue before us, but issues that came up that were discussed with the stakeholders and changes were made. And again, I think part of the issue too is appellant's contention that, you know, I think they've used the term by legislative or by administrative fiat, that the registrar could just reimpose the 30-day bond release letter requirement. That's not how it's done. That's not how the BMV releases these policies. These policies go through, as was testified by both Ms. Stutfield and Ms. Corrigan, they go through multiple steps. They're reviewed. They talk to stakeholders. They take stakeholder input. They take input from the clerks of court, input from auto dealers. And so because of that, that again makes it even more unlikely that this policy would be reinstated on a whim.
Well, let me ask you this. Is it your position that the BMV instituted this policy or rescinded this policy, I should say, because of the information that they received from NHTSA, or is it because there was an initial misreading of the regulation to begin with?
So they rescinded the policy based on advice from NHTSA. When they had the conversation with Coleman Sachs from NHTSA, that's what sparked the change. That's what, and I will agree that 7 months seems like a long time to enact a change in a policy, except when you're dealing with a large bureaucracy. I don't think anybody has ever accused of any bureaucracy of moving too quickly. So the fact that it goes through a lot of steps, it goes through a lot of channels. So 7 months isn't exactly outside the realm of possibility for how long it would take for them to rescind a policy.
But there was no misreading of the regulation?
Not that it was stated by the BMV. That's not their position. They misread the regulation. Their position was the regulation allowed them to enact the policy they enacted. but because of advice from NHTSA after the fact. And I believe the policy was testified by Ms. Stedfeld that she had spoken with officials from NHTSA before the policy was enacted, before the October of 2015 policy was initially enacted. And based on that advice is how that came about. So while the BMV does not agree that they were that it was a mistake or it was a misreading of the regulations, it was based on advice from NHTSA, they do realize that based on current practices and past practices from NHTSA, they should not require a strict bond release letter requirement. It is because NHTSA cannot currently get them out, and even if they could get them out in the future, this could happen again, and there'd be no reason to reenact a policy that already works at the present time, that is in line with the federal regulations and that is permitted by the federal regulations. Again, I think I just want to address a couple points that were made by the appellant too. He mentions that Judge Helmick, I believe, in his, I think it was in 2017 or 2018, he made his decision on the motion to dismiss, and he found that the case was not moot. However, in that case, again, it's a standard of review that's different for a standard for summary judgment. So the only evidence before Judge Helmick when he made his decision on the motion to dismiss was the complaint and the answer to the complaint, or actually the motion to dismiss. There was no answer at that point. So because of that, his standard was there is a plausible claim that this case was not mooted, that it wasn't done in good faith, at least based on the assertions of the appellant or the plaintiffs at the time. That changed after discovery, after there was testimony by members of the BMV showing that they had been looking into the policy before this case was even filed, looking into it based on complaints by both auto dealers associations, based on complaints relayed to them by the
court. And what you're telling me now is that based on the depositions with Corrigan, when you said they'd been looking into it and so on?
Well, yes. So, it was the depositions and, in fact, the email. So the email from Coleman Sachs does show that they were looking into it. It just shows that they looked into it in May of 2016, and that they were continuing to look into it. And they by December of 2016, they finally had rescinded the policy or issued a new title broadcast that, among many other things, rescinded that policy. Based on the evidence before Judge Sargas, there was certainly more evidence than just the assertions of plaintiff, and at that time the evidence showed that there was no reasonable expectation that the BMV would reinstate this policy. In fact, it wasn't just based on the BMV saying we promise we won't, or the registrar saying he promises he won't. It was based on the testimony under oath of two BMV officials. It was based on emails that were provided through discovery between the federal government and the BMV. It was based on several factors that were.
When you say emails, are you referring singular to the one from May 2nd, or is there another one?
So there were other emails, at least between BMV parties, that referenced communications. Those were the March emails. So the March emails referenced communications that the BMV had, and it was internal communications between BMV staffers explaining what they were learning. And then in May is when they sent the email to Coleman Sachs and when he replied. So there's several emails in that respect, and then there's also testimony from two members of the BMV. And I'm sorry, I my time is up. I see the red light. So,
any more questions?
Any more questions? Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Thank you. I will, of necessity, be quick, but say the important thing first. I've learned that now at this age. And the important thing is think about how arcane this question is. This is the intersection of two subsections of the Code of Federal Regulations with an administrative regulation in the state of Ohio. And its arcanity, matters for this reason. If there's no intention to reinstate this, why hold on to this hour to the ability to restate it? Why not just say, yeah, they were in conflict, we let it go? And
well, when you say the give up the ability, would that require them to put something in the code that says we no longer have any power to issue regs in this area?
No, but I think it lends an interpretive gloss to the case.
Well, counsel, if you were in our position to order them to do something, what would you like to order them to do?
I would like to enjoin them from ever again requiring a bond release letter as part of the application for a title to a Box 3 vehicle, so that they don't do it again, because they have held on. You know, they're kicking and screaming to not let go of it.
Help me here. I thought the bond release letter was still required, but then would be waived after 30 days.
Correct.
So and you want them not to require it at all?
Well, no, after 30 days, that's fine if that's what the policy says. But the point is that the old policy conflicted, and we want a holding to that effect. Here, the
in
state,
other words, you want an advisory opinion on a policy that hasn't been in effect for six years.
Well, it's not been
5 years.
No, it's not an advisory opinion, because that high burden of showing mootness and the lack of jurisdiction that comes with it is not a burden that they have remotely carried. You know, W.T. Grant, the Supreme Court, used the language that they had to show that the risk of reinstatement was completely and irrevocably removed. And they've just not done that. They confess they still have the power. They still have at least some interest, because they're defending the power to do it. Briefly, with respect to when things were noticed, again, that 7-month period, in that year, 75,000 Box 3 vehicles were imported to Ohio. Over a 9-month period, presumably some 50,000 of them were straighted.
You're not asking for damages for
No, we can't get damages. I mean, there's you know, there'd be 11 of them.
It's not bad,
there.
But what's the point of all those vehicles?
Well, the point of all those vehicles is it shows that, well, they're saying they acted with alacrity, or alternatively saying that they're a big bureaucracy with lead feet. They've named 5 people in the decision-making process, all in the same office. It's not like the legislative process that involves committees and hearings and drafts, and so creates some sort of a greater presumption that it's not going to happen again because the legislative process has been gone through. I am out of time.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. I'll give you a couple minutes to switch tables, and then the clerk may call the next case.